Welcome to tonight's program. Good evening, truth seekers, and all that stuff. My name's Mike Malloy. This hour is sponsored by Francis Cummins. And the message from Francis Cummins: help your child succeed, turn off the television, and encourage your child to play and read for fun. That is solid gold. This hour is sponsored by Francis Cummins. Where to begin tonight? Where to begin? What did Boehner say today? That the vote today by the House to cut taxes for every, leave the tax cuts in place for everybody who makes under $250,000. Boehner called that chicken crap. Oh my God. You notice he got a haircut if you saw him on television, and he's added a couple more hours a day in the tanning booth. He's about to become, once again, the House Majority Leader. It's chicken crap. Speaker, that's right. Speaker of the House. What am I talking about? It's the other guy. Cantor is the House Majority Leader. Some really crazy stuff going on. It's humor. We don't live in a country any longer that has pride of accomplishment, pride of innovation, pride of our manufacturing base, our dedication to building a strong middle class. That's not where we live anymore. We don't live in a country where parents or the generation between 40 and 70 says to itself, well, I do know that I'm going to leave a better future for my children. We don't live there anymore. We don't live there anymore. We don't live in a country where the average 16-year-old can say, wow, one more year and I'll be able to go to college. We don't live in that country any longer. We live in a crazed national state security organization run by crazy people. You know it as well as I know it. I got something for you about Obama tonight that's, if it doesn't fry your hair, I don't know what it will take for you Democrats to finally come out of the ether regarding El Presidente. But I'm getting ahead of myself. From the Houston Chronicle, some Republicans in that state who talk about Texas potentially opting out of Medicaid because the state is broke after all these years of Republican leadership, opting out of Medicaid, are quick to say that the changes won't really throw people out on the street. But the state of Texas House Appropriations Committee Chairman, a freak named Jim Pitts, Republican from Waxahachie, isn't saying that. He was at a meeting of the Ellis County Tea Party crazy people today. And a member of the audience raised his hand, and Mars Pitts called on him. And the guy in the audience asked about an ill friend who's on Medicaid. The guy asking the question reacted with concern, you see, when Pitts said the state is looking at getting out of Medicaid, just getting out of it. And the guy in the audience said, well, what will my friend do then? Will you throw him out in the street? And the Republican Tea Partier, Jim Pitts of Waxahachie, Texas, said, well, if we did exactly what we're doing today, we wouldn't be throwing him out in the street. But if we have any savings in getting out of Medicaid, we will have to throw some people out in the street. Jesus Christ. I wonder if Mr. Pitts' mama would be one that would be thrown out on the street, or his grandmama, or his auntie, or I don't know, maybe a cousin of his who is on Medicaid. Surely this Republican bastard has at least one family member on Medicaid. Surely he does. But to the people of Texas, suck it up. Suck it up, boys and girls. This is what you wanted, and you got it. You want some numbers in Texas? In fiscal year 2011, Texas expects to spend $24.7 billion on Medicaid, including $16.6 billion that comes from the federal government. More than 60% of nursing home residents in Texas have Medicaid coverage that covers at least part of their nursing home costs. As of April this year, there were 52,235 Medicaid clients in nursing homes. And this pig bastard, Pitts, has said, yeah, well, we're going to have to put some people on the street. All these old people. Street. There are currently 3.1 million Texans on Medicaid. That includes 2.2 million children who qualify based on their age and income. 2.2 million children. And this filthy pig bastard Pitts, who is in the Texas legislature, who sits on the Texas House Appropriations Committee, this filthy animal said, if we have any savings in getting out of Medicaid, we will have to throw some people out in the street. God damn, how about that? We'll try to make sure it's all Democrats. Medicaid is the health lifeline for more than 3 million of the most vulnerable Texans, according to the Houston Chronicle. But Republicans, including Governor Rick Goodhair Perry, are talking about getting out of the program as a means of trying to deal with their massive state budget shortfall, which is a result of the mismanagement by the Republicans who have been running the state of Texas for how long now? Huh? But let's kick women on Medicaid who are getting breast cancer treatments. Let's kick them into the streets. Let's kick kids who are dealing with childhood cancer, a child getting cancer treatment. Let's kick the child into the street. Let the little bastard die. Let the women who are poor and on Medicaid dealing with breast cancer treatment, let them die too. Let the men who are on Medicaid who are dealing with prostate cancer or lung cancer and getting treatment, let them die. Kick them to the goddamn street. Kick them to the street. Right, Texas? Ah, right? You pigs. You pigs. See, the Republicans who gained strength nationwide and in the state of Texas have promised that by God and Jesus and anybody else, we're not going to raise taxes. No, we're not. But we have a multi-billion dollar shortfall here in the state of Texas, held in just about every state in the South. We have a massive shortfall. So, God damn it, we got to cut somewhere. We're not gonna tax the millionaires and billionaires. Hell no, we can't do that. We're gonna end Medicaid. We're gonna throw children and sick men and women, unemployed, poor, no health insurance, on Medicaid. We're gonna throw them into the street. Because, you know, we're not gonna raise income taxes here in the great state of Texas. We're the Lone Star State. By God, we used to be a republic, you know. Hell, we're talking about seceding from the Union. I hate these son of a bitches with a passion that I can't describe on the radio. Because if I did, within 30 minutes there'd be police here to take my ass away.
effort to listen to Right Wing Radio, here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. We've got, first of all, I've got to mention, last night I mispronounced the name of the man who sponsored, what was it, Kathy, the first or second hour. I said his name was Na Nguyen, because I went for the literal spelling of his last name, literal pronunciation. And as Andrea writes in, it is not pronounced Nguyen, it's pronounced Win. So his name should have been pronounced Na Win. Thanks to Andrea for correcting that for me, and my apologies to Mr. Win for doing an American tap dance on his name. I do apologize. Na Win is his name, Win. This hour is sponsored by Francis Cummins. More from the Tea Party crazy people who are slowly but surely taking over the political system. This one's from California. Judson Phillips is the president of Tea Party Nation. And he made the statement today or yesterday, recently, that restricting voting in this country to property owners makes a lot of sense. Phillips made the comment in his weekly Tea Party radio program. This is what he said, quote, "The founding fathers originally said they put certain restrictions on who got the right to vote. It wasn't you were just a citizen and you automatically got to vote. Some of the restrictions, you know, you obviously would not think about today, but one of them was you had to be a property owner. And that makes a lot of sense, because if you're a property owner, you actually have a vested stake in the community. And if you're not a property owner, you know, I'm sorry, but property owners have a little bit more of a vested stake in the community than non-property owners do." End quote. 95 million Americans rent their homes. A lot of people are losing their homes. A lot more people are going to be renters very quickly, because people who Judson Phillips would back, no matter what they did, decided to rip off the American public with home mortgage loans that nobody could afford. Renters are one-third of the U.S. population, in other words. When the United States was founded, most states restricted voting to property owners, but these restrictions were phased out in the early 1800s. Dean Preston, executive director of Tenants Together, a statewide tenant rights organization in California, a state with an estimated 14 million renters, said, Dean Preston said, "Mr. Phillips owes an apology to the millions of Americans who rent their homes. Tenants Together sent a letter today demanding a formal apology from Phillips and the Tea Party Nation that he represents." And then there is David Hedrick, a failed congressional candidate. He's a Tea Partier who launched an eventually unsuccessful run for Congress after achieving viral fame for a combative tirade at a town hall meeting in the summer of 2009. In 2009, Hedrick vehemently charged that Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi should be checking her sleeve for Nazi insignia. And he's now written a children's book called The Liberal Clause. It's a children's Tea Party Christmas book. Here's how the Rupert Murdoch anti-American terrorist television network describes the plot. Liberal Claus forces the elves to unionize, bails out the sled industry with town money, and stipulates that all children be given the same amount of toys, no matter if they've been naughty or nice. He cites a liberal clause in the town's Christmas tuition that allows him to get away with all of this, along with trying to control elf-made global warming and forcing townsfolk to attend a church presided over by a Reverend Blight. In the end, one little girl defends the Christmas tuition and saves the town from Liberal Claus's takeover by unplugging his teleprompter. The Rupert Murdoch anti-American terrorist broadcasting organization also reports that Hedrick's book has got him booked for a Christmas episode of Comedy Central's The Daily Show. Oh, by the way, complicating matters is the fact that Hedrick is in the midst of a legal proceeding defending himself after he assaulted his wife. Sasha Brown Warsham at the Stir blog points out that this newly decided children's author is the same man who stood before a couple hundred people last summer and angrily yelled at a U.S. congressman to stay away from my kids. Now Hedrick is encouraging other people's kids to read a book sprinkled with some of the more controversial beliefs of the Tea Party and the birther movements. And hopefully this rancid son of a bitch will go to jail for beating up his wife.
Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing and most likely will take.
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, and this first hour of the Malloy program tonight, sponsored by Francis Cummins, who sends a message, help your child succeed, turn off the television, encourage your child to play and read for fun. Ah, absolutely. You want some more craziness? See, I'm trying to ease you into this thing about El Presidente, who was born in the United States, who is not a Muslim, and who just seems incapable under the present circumstances of leading, which I guess is understandable. There are 24 shopping days left till Christmas, 23 actually, and 170 days left until Jesus returns. You didn't know that, did you? That's the message on 40 billboards around Nashville. The rapture is going to be May 21st, coming 2011. Billboards are up in 8 other U.S. cities also. This comes from the Tennessean, the newspaper in Nashville. This is all being done by Family Radio Incorporated, a nationwide Christian radio network. Family Radio's founder, Harold Camping, says May 21st, 2011 is the rapture. And the billboard, if you've seen the picture of it, the message is simple. He is coming again. And then the date. The aim of this group of psychopaths is to get unbelievers to turn around quickly. Oh, Lord, yes! Critics say the billboards are a waste of time. One, really? Another failed attempt to predict the end of the world. Well, not the end of the world, just the end of these rapture-ready bastards. I hope it does happen. Please, Sky Spook, make it happen. May 21st, 2011. Remove these sons of bitches from my planet. Please take them. And when they rapture up to heaven, I'm going to go around to all their houses with a gun and kill their pets. Just for pure meanness. Someone named Allison Warden. Is that a woman? Yeah. She's 29. This poor, miserable creature. She's the one who orchestrated Nashville's billboard campaign. She says that the rapture is going to be a great day for God's people, but awful for everyone else. She's a volunteer with WeCanKnow.com, a website set up by followers of Family Radio. WeCanKnow.com. Why don't y'all go there, and if there's a message board, put a bunch of obscenities on there. And just say there's a radio crazy person in Atlanta who says when they do rapture, he's going to go around with guns and kill all their pets. I'll shoot the sons of bitches. I'll unplug their fish tanks. I will take the little birdies out of their cages in there and just hold them by the beak and flip them. Anyway, she and other fans designed the billboards along with T-shirts, bumper stickers, and postcards to get
Family Radio's Harold Camping's predictions out. Amen.
Young Miss Warden traveled from her home in Raleigh, North Carolina, to Nashville last week to check out the billboards purchased through the end of the year. She wouldn't say how much they cost or name who paid for them. None of your goddamn business, was her reaction, sort of. She is absolutely sure that Mr. Camping's prediction is right. She said, it's a certainty. Now, this is not the first time this is done. A former NASA engineer, a guy named Edgar Huisenant, sold millions of copies of his book back several years ago called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. Oh, my God. What's that book we have in the upstairs bathroom? How to Profit from the Coming Rapture. How to Profit from the Coming Rapture. It's written by Steve and Edie Levy. It's a great book. Richard Landis, director of the Center for Millennial Studies at Boston University, said predictions at the end of the world provide relief from the pressures of daily life for some. That's why they continue to be so popular. Mr. Landis said, quote, whatever the mess your life is in, it makes everything nice and simple if you know when the end is coming, right? Now, Tom Evans, a spokesman for Family Radio, insisted the predictions are true, and he and the other Family Radio supporters want to save their friends and neighbors from God's judgments. The billboards are also up in Louisville, St. Louis, Detroit, Little Rock, Omaha, Kansas City, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Bridgeport, Connecticut. And in cities with Family Radio affiliated station, the message is on the R. See, the latest prediction apparently comes from a verse in Luke 17, chapter 17, and it says, quote, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man, end quote. And Tom Evans, a spokesman for these crazy people, said it's just a matter of simple math. According to Mr. Camping's prediction, the rapture will happen exactly 7,000 years from the date that God first warned people about the flood. Mr. Camping said the flood happened in 4990 B.C. on what would have been May 21st in the modern calendar, and God gave Noah 1 week of warning. Now, since we all know that one day equals 1,000 years for God, we all know that, don't we? One day equals 1,000 years. Amen. That means there was a 7,000-year interval between the flood and rapture. You see, 7,000 years equals 7 days, which is a week. You see? So, Mr. Camping said, we hope that anyone would get a Bible out and try to prove that this is wrong. To spread their message, Family Radio is also sending out caravans of RVs across the country with the rapture message. One should make its way to Nashville after the first of the year. They're sending missionaries around the world to hand out tracts. But Mr. Camping says only about 3% of the people who see the billboards will take them seriously. He said, quote, sadly, only 8 people survived the flood in Noah's time, and the number of people that are going to be saved is going to be very small. And then the Nashville Tennessean quotes one Nashville resident who's not quite convinced. It's Sophie Bowes. She's a manager at Whiskey Kitchen. That's the downtown restaurant closest to one of these billboards. She says she's never seen a message like it. She added, "Wow, welcome to the South."
Amen, amen, and amen.
May 11, 2011, or May 21st, 2011, hallelujah. Please, please, please be right in your prediction, you crazy old bastard. Please. I want all the rapture-ready people to leave. Get the hell off my planet. Get off my planet. You don't belong here. You're insane. Go. Scram and take your psychopathology with you. Speaking of psychopathology, man, have I got a third hour for you tonight. Bob Alexander is reading. He's always reading. The guy makes me nervous. He's always reading. Scary. But he read something called Political Ponerology, a science on the nature of evil adjusted for political purposes by Andrei Lobachevsky. Don't try to remember it all. But you might want to look up the word ponerology, P-O-N-E-R-O-L-O-G-Y. It's either ponerology or ponerology. I think it's ponerology. P-O-N-E-R-O-L-O-G-Y. And Bob sent this to me 3 or 4 days ago, and I'm just getting around to it now. It's the study of evil. But you may want to look it up. And also, is anyone familiar with MK Ultra? Program back in the 50s that was designed by the military to is a horrible program. If you've ever seen the movie Jacob's Ladder, it was based. Who had the lead in that? What was the guy's name? Tim Robbins, right? It was based on some of the MK Ultra experiments, but updated to the Vietnamese invasion and slaughter of our people and the Vietnamese. It was engineered by Eisenhower. When Kennedy tried to get us out, he was murdered. Johnson, when he tried to get us out, he had to resign. Nixon, until finally enough Americans and enough Vietnamese had been slaughtered, and capitalism was satisfied and licked its bloody lips and walked away. Jacob's Ladder is a film about some of those drug experiments that used American soldiers as guinea pigs, unknowing, of course, of what was going on. But anyway, that's coming up the third hour. Hell, we're not even through the first. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy.
The Flying Monkey Right. It's Mike Molloy.
10 before the hour. Kay, our education correspondent, writes in, not about education. She writes, "Mike, regarding that California Tea Party who claims that only property owners have a vested interest in their communities and should therefore be the only ones to vote, which California does this guy live in? If he's in Southern California, he has to know about the LA housing market. And if he's up this way, there is no way he could not know about the insanity that is San Francisco real estate. Despite the outrageous cost of housing here, many people choose to stay and rent rather than move to a community where housing is cheaper. These people are incredibly committed to their communities. If they were not, they would be doing what so many have had to do in order to achieve the American dream, move out of the area or even out of the state. What a blanking blank hole. Ow! Okay. And Roz in California regarding the rapture crazy people. Like, if these idiots ever really read the Bible, they would see that in Matthew it says that Jesus said nobody knows the hour of his coming, not even he. Only the Father knew. That's not verbatim, but I can remember reading that. What on earth is wrong with these people? Christians around the world are absolutely nothing like their American cousins. The Americans are a breed unto themselves. What a bunch of... Wait a minute, didn't I just read that? Oh, what a bunch of weirdos, Roz. And from our friend Dr. Sachs, who plays with Count Basie. Dr. Sachs is, I have noticed over the course of a couple of years that he's been emailing me from around the world as he is on tour with the Count Basie Orchestra, that Dr. Sachs is getting a little bit, more than a little bit irritated with the way the Caucasians are acting. And, you know, I find that admirable that he only gets a little bit irritated. I go crazy with the way the Caucasians are acting. And I are one. Well, not really. I'm Italian and Irish, and we were never considered really white. Dr. Sachs writes, Mike, what's up with white folks lately, man? I mean, damn. The more they talk, the more angry I get. I feel like it's 1955 again. Like in the movie. What do they call you up north, boy? They call me Mr. Tibbs. Remember that from In the Heat of the Night? How do you call the president very urban and then deny what you really meant and then send your cronies to television to redefine urban? Steve King, representative from New York, needs to just put on his hood so we know where he stands. Everybody knows urban is the new word for black. Urban music. Urban areas. What a bunch of crap. And a legal ruling for black farmers who were denied the original monies is reparations? Is this fool out of his mind? Of course not. He knows exactly what racial code words he's putting out there. Mitch McConnell needs to be blank, blank, blank. I just don't want to read that on the air. Dr. Sachs. And these other folks need a beat down. Seriously, I'm trying to be cool, but this stuff is over the top. Toss in a side of Glenn Beck, and now that they've cut off unemployment, all hell is going to break loose. There will be blood in the streets, just like you said. And Beck will be there laughing and rolling his fingers like he is in two flew over the cuckoo's nest. Bro, this is just looking bad out there. Obama needs to slap one of these guys in the face and say, they call me Mr. President. I'm out. Dr. Sachs. Yeah. What he's talking about, of course, is black farmers who were denied the same kind of government assistance that white farmers got for years and years and years, especially here in the South. Lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit has been filed over the past 20, 30 years, 40 years, something, I don't know. It's been a long time. Finally, reparations, I love that word, reparations were decided upon not for 300 years of slavery, but for cheating black farmers from what they were entitled to. And apparently, I usually don't pay too much attention to what Representative Steve King, or whatever his name, Peter King, says. The guy just makes me nervous. He looks like, you know, that's a guy with a big white bush on his head. He looks like a mafia hitman. He really does. He just looks like the stereotypical movie mafia hitman. And he makes me nervous as he makes me very nervous. But apparently he got his bloomers in a wad. And I'm sure Beck and the rest of the pigs that work for the Rupert Murdoch anti-American terrorist organization also made a big deal about it. Yeah, don't give the Negroes anything. I mean, I can understand that, because that was the perfect capitalist model. You have these millions of people coming over here, and if millions of them died on the way over, well, I'll just throw the sons of bitches in the ocean, shark food, who cares? But if all these people can come over here...
You're calling them people?
All right. If all these slaves can come over here, then we can build some enormous fortunes. We can conquer the land. We can export cotton. We can do wondrous things, and don't worry about the slaves. They are slaves, and it says in the Bible that a slave should respect the master. When we come back, I have something for you that is probably going to make you a little bit uncomfortable. Stay with us. This hour is sponsored by Borden. By Gordon. Gordon? By Gordon Besnoska. Gordon in Oklahoma. Thanks, Gordon. The message that comes with his sponsorship is no message. The hour is sponsored by Gordon Besnoska. The WikiLeaks revelations continue, and I would have eventually come to this because I'm a Mother Jones subscriber and I like what David Korn writes about and says, and somebody emailed me and said it was on Korn was on Hartman's program today. But in the midst of all that, I get an email from Bob Alexander. Subject line is, I'm shocked. Let me share with you what David Korn has written to Mother Jones online. In its first months in office, the Obama administration sought to protect the Bush administration officials facing criminal investigation overseas for their involvement in establishing policies that govern the interrogations of detained terrorist suspects. A confidential, quote, April 17th, 2009 cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Madrid to the State Department. This cable was one of the 251,287 cables obtained by WikiLeaks. That cable details how the Obama administration, working with Republicans, leaned on Spain to derail this potential prosecution. The previous month, a Spanish human rights group called the Association for the Dignity of Spanish Prisoners had requested that Spain's national court indict six former Bush officials for, as the cable describes it, quote, creating a legal framework that allegedly permitted torture, end quote. The six were former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, David Addington, former chief of staff and legal advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, William Haynes, the Pentagon's former general counsel, Douglas Feith, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Jay Bybee, former head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, and John Yoo, former official in the Office of Legal Counsel. The human rights group contended that Spain had a duty to open an investigation under that nation's universal jurisdiction law, which permits its legal system to prosecute overseas human rights crimes involving Spanish citizens and residents. Five Guantanamo detainees, the group maintained, fit that or those criteria. Soon after the request was made, the U.S. Embassy in Madrid began tracking the matter. On April 1st, our embassy officials, spoke with Chief Prosecutor Javier Zaragoza, who indicated that he was not pleased to have been handed this case, but he believed that the complaint appeared to be well documented and he'd have to pursue it. Around that time, the acting deputy chief of the U.S. Embassy talked to the chief of staff for Spain's foreign minister and a senior official in the Spanish Ministry of Justice to convey, as the cable says, quote, that this was a very serious matter for the U.S. government, end quote. The two Spaniards, quote, expressed their concern at the case, but stressed the independence of the Spanish judiciary, end quote. 2 weeks later, Senator Judd Gregg, Republican of New Hampshire, and the embassy's charge d'affaires, two different people, Senator Judd Gregg and the embassy's charge d'affaires, raised the issue with another official at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Spain. The next day, Zaragoza informed the U.S. embassy that the complaint might not be legally sound. He noted he would ask Conde Pumpido, Spain's attorney general, to review whether Spain had jurisdiction. On April 15th, Senator Mel Martinez, Republican of Florida, who'd recently been chairman of the Republican Party and the U.S. Embassy's charge d'affaires, met with the acting Spanish foreign minister, Angel Losada. The Americans, according to this cable, quote, underscored that the prosecutions would not be understood or accepted in the U.S. and would have an enormous impact on the bilateral relationship between Spain and the United States, end quote. Here was a former head of the Republican Party and a representative of a new Democratic administration, headed, by the way, by a president who had decried the Bush-Cheney administration's use of torture, jointly applying pressure on Spain to kill the investigation of the former Bush officials. Losada, the acting Spanish foreign minister, replied that the independence of the Spanish judiciary had to be respected, but he added that the government would send a message to the Attorney General of Spain that it did not favor prosecuting the case. The next day, April 16th, 2009, Attorney General Conde Pumpido publicly declared that he would not support the criminal complaint, calling it fraudulent and political. If the Bush officials had acted criminally, he said, then a case should be filed in the United States. On April 17th, the prosecutors of the National Court filed a report asking the complaint to be discontinued. In the April 17th cable, the American Embassy in Madrid claimed some credit for Conde Pumpido's opposition, noting that, quote, Conde Pumpido's public announcement follows outreach to the government of Spain's officials to raise U.S. government's deep concerns on the implications of this case, end quote. Still, this did not end the matter. It would still be up to investigating Judge Baltazar Garzon, a world-renowned jurist who had initiated previous prosecutions of war crimes and had publicly said that former President George W. Bush ought to be tried for war crimes. It would still be up to him to decide whether to pursue the case against the six former Bush officials. That June, coincidentally or not, the Spanish Parliament passed legislation narrowing the use of so-called universal jurisdiction. Still, in September 2009, Judge Garzon pushed ahead with the case. The case eventually came to be overseen by another judge who last spring asked the parties behind the complaint to explain why the investigation should continue. Several human rights groups filed a brief urging this judge to keep the case alive, citing the Obama administration's failure to prosecute the Bush officials. Since then, there's been no action. The Obama administration essentially got what it wanted. The case of the Bush Six went away. Back when it seemed that this case would become a major international issue, during an April 14, 2009 White House briefing, I asked Press Secretary Robert Gibbs if the Obama administration would cooperate with any requests from the Spaniards for information and documents related to the Bush Six. He said, quote, "I don't want to get involved in hypotheticals," end quote. What he didn't disclose was that the Obama administration, working with Republicans, was actively pressuring the Spaniards to drop the investigation. Those efforts apparently paid off. And as this WikiLeaks released cable shows, Gonzalez, Haynes, Fife, Bybee, Addington, and you owed Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton thank you notes. David Corn is Mother Jones, Washington Bureau Chief. And as Bob wrote, Bob Alexander, he said, before you read this in the email he sent me, you may want to keep a wastebasket or some other type of receptacle handy because the dry heaves the story induces may turn into full-blown vomiting. Well, remember, Bob writes, how the Spanish prosecutor was getting ready to go after the Bush Six, and all of a sudden, poof, story all gone. Now we know the nuts and bolts of why. Bob adds, I may have had a neuron or two that still believed Obama was a decent human being, but not now. Obama collaborated with the Republicans to stomp this line of inquiry flat. The last scintilla of hope I had has been blown away by a snort of disgust.
Go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
Yeah, let Mikey do it. 21 past the hour. Now, on top of what I just shared with you from David Corn, Irish Dave sends me a item here from El País, the Spanish newspaper, dated today. I believe it's from today. Yeah. And the first part is in Espanol, but the rest of it is in English. And what it is a cable, confidential, sent from Madrid. And I'll read a little bit to you. The Mallorcan Free Association of Attorneys, that's a group, and a group of Mallorcan professionals filed a motion calling upon National Court Judge Ismael Moreno to name 13 presumed U.S. government officials as suspects in connection with the transit of a CIA flight that stopped in Palma de Mallorca in January 2004. The Attorneys Association and the Mallorcan professionals are the plaintiffs in a suit alleging torture, kidnapping, and illegal detention on the part of the CIA. The second paragraph, the plaintiffs, it was the people asking the Spanish court for relief. The plaintiffs drew the names from a report prepared by Spain's Civil Guard in 2005 regarding the occupants of a Boeing 737 with tail number N313P. The Civil Guard investigation was requested by the local court in Mallorca, where the plaintiffs originally filed their case. The plaintiffs claim that this particular aircraft participated in the extraordinary rendition of German national Khaled al-Masri in Macedonia after departing from Spanish territory. The names of the alleged occupants include, and then it lists 12 or 13 of them. Press reports indicate that at least five of the persons named above held U.S. diplomatic passports. In order for the plaintiff's demand to proceed, it must be supported by National Court Prosecutor Vicente Gonzalez Mota and approved by Judge Moreno. Judge Moreno has already entered into evidence the October 9 testimony of Khalid Al-Masri, as well as telephone logs from the Grand Melia Victoria Hotel and the Marriott Son Antem in Palma de Mallorca, where the crew of the aircraft in question stayed during their stopover in Mallorca. And then it goes to paragraph four. There's a bunch of stuff here, but let me go to paragraph four. It is possible this case could eventually result in an official request to the U.S. government by the National Court for information related to this aircraft and the personnel on the aircraft. While the Spanish government has maintained that no crimes were committed in Spanish territory, the Spanish courts, including Judge Moreno, have asserted universal jurisdiction in cases involving torture, including in third countries. And there's more. The point, of course, is that if you have any doubts that we live in a country whose leadership is totally unconcerned about the consequences of his actions where it concerns American citizens. And this obviously includes the highest levels of leadership in the Democratic Party. We know it includes the Republicans. Republicans are neo-fascist. That's just understood. You can tell. It's not because some 25-cent talk show host identifies them as neo-fascist. You look at their record. The Democrats are a little bit more subtle about it. But there is no question that Barack Obama and the Republican leadership that was involved in this worked in tandem to quash this investigation, indictment, extradition, trial, conviction, and punishment of the Bush Six. Now, why Obama would do that is your speculation is as good as mine. Is it because Obama is a complete fraud? Is it because Obama is afraid? A fraud, afraid? Is it because Obama, simply because of the cultural understanding he's had, cannot stand up to white men in this government, whether they're Democrats or Republicans? Could that be? Could it be, fourth reason, could it be because he understands his historical importance as the first African-American president of the United States and doesn't want to jeopardize it by being a pushy black man? Could that be? I don't know. And you don't know. The only one who really knows, I guess, is Barack Obama. I'm sure he knows why he does what he's doing. But to protect criminals, isn't that an accessory after the fact? I mean, is there not a legal term for that? Does that not make him an equal conspirator?
Nobody ever loved me like she does. Oh, she does. Yes, she does. And if somebody like you do me, oh, she do me, yes, she does. Don't let me down. Don't let
up America one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, and the hour is sponsored by Gordon Beznoska. Gordon in OKC. Thank you, Gordon. Isn't it bizarre? I mean, isn't this just incredible stuff? Do you ever feel like you're living inside a Twilight Zone episode? I do. I do all the time. I really do. No, not all the time. When I'm only connected to my family, I don't. But when I'm connected to anything that is even remotely associated with my job, yeah, I do. It's just bizarre. And lately I've been paying a lot of attention as I'm out and about, you know, going to the farmer's market, going to the gas station, going to take Molly to ballet, whatever. Paying a lot of attention to people, other people in their cars or walking down the street or people you kind of but people you see in grocery stores. Another place, you know, gas stations. Just looking at faces. I used to do that a lot when I was younger. I used to, sit around. I'm sure you've done it. You go someplace, you find a comfortable place to sit. Usually in a downtown park or an area where people congregate for lunch or whatever. And it's great fun if you do it. You get your own lunch or a cup of coffee, and you sit and watch people and make up stories in your head about the people, about the woman with the chihuahua on the leash, or the mom with her two kids, or the guy who looks like he just came from some business meeting, or, you know, whatever. You sit there and just make up whole histories about people. Have you ever done that? God, I used to do that a lot. And what I've noticed lately, it's almost impossible to do it because what I'm seeing is an awful lot of people who seem stunned. Just kind of stunned. I know during the 90s, when I used to play this little Mike Malloy game here in Atlanta, and then we moved to Chicago for a while. And in the 90s when I play this game, I see a lot of animated conversation. And if you drift over and start listening, you hear deals being made, plans being made, just all kinds of intriguing little conversations. Or if not a conversation, animation on the faces of the people. At least this is what I used to see. Animation, a lot of color. Color in people's faces. Didn't make any difference what their skin color was, but color, you know, just crackle, something, I don't know. And now what I notice is that's not there. It's not there. It's just simply not there. And it's not like I'm seeing only people who are unemployed or only people who are about to lose their homes or only people who can't figure out where the next mortgage payment's coming. I'm just talking about a general visual sweeping across the crowds that flow past me no matter where I'm at, in a car, on a street, in a store. What's really been weird is to go into the malls. There are three malls that Kathy and I occasionally will go into to do some shopping, to look around. Usually not, but just to look around and watching the people. You know, we are in the perversion season. The total perversion season. I guess about 30, 40 years ago when I started to realize that Christmas had been turned into, the baby Jesus had been whored into something unrecognizable. You know, the very guy who, according to their mythology, drove the money changers out of the temple. And it's become such a perversion that it no longer is Christmas. I mean, it just isn't. You know, these right-wingers say, no, happy holidays. It's got to be Merry Christmas. You know, you people are so goddamn sick, it staggers the imagination. But to go into the malls and see what has now become Yuletide, and which I have no problem with. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a Yuletide celebration on this program. When are we doing that? 23rd? 23rd. But to see the decorations in the malls, it looks to me like whoever decorated the stores, like Macy's or Lord & Taylor or Target, whatever, they're not aware that we're in a depression. I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen so much stuff out. Stuff. Just acres, miles of stuff. Now, that makes it no different from any perverted Christ child celebration season. It's always been that way, for the very longest time. Once the retailers and the capitalists realize, hey, this is easy, son of a bitch. Let's just link buying crap to the baby Jesus. Oh, my God. This is what... But what I'm noticing is the faces, the people. Even in the lines to take the kid to see Santa Claus, which it may be my imagination. I'm sure it probably is because I'm such a cynical bastard at this point. But I even notice the parents in those lines are not, there's no smiles. There's no, you know, there's no, oh, good, let's see. And the kids, even the kids. And this is the part that is really spooky to me, is to see kids who, aside from the usual fear of this great, large, red and white beast sitting in the chair that the kid has to go sit, whose lap the kid has to go sit on and say, I want a bicycle. You know, as frightening as that is, aside from that, the blank look on the kids' faces, too. You know, I told Kathy the other day, I said, you know, I'm just hallucinating, you know. This is a result from all those drugs all those years ago. I'm just, you know, I'm flashing out here. She said, well, I never did those drugs. And I see the same thing. Okay. Something is... something's very, very disconnected. I used to feel plugged in to this country. Did you feel that? Did you ever feel that? And I've never done anything spectacularly sacrificing. You know, I've worked in Feed the Hungry programs. I've collected food and clothing. I've done this and done that. What most people have done. Nothing spectacular. But either because of that or in spite of it, I always felt connected. I mean, really rooted, grounded, connected to this country. And it didn't make any difference what kind of crazy people were in government. I always thought that, you know, okay, things will work out because most people want to see the best for this country. Even though I found out later that while I had that kind of Pollyanna-ish attitude, all sorts of... dark things and chicanery and bloodletting was going on in the name of the United States all over the globe. But I always felt connected. I just chose to be ignorant, I guess. I don't know. I believed what the teachers told me. I just went along with the program. And, you know, when you're in your teens or 20s or 30s, you're still, you know, really kind of self-referential, right? Everything is kind of like me, me, me. That illusion of central position hasn't weakened yet, or it certainly hasn't dissolved. It may have weakened a bit, like, oh, my God, the universe doesn't revolve around me. Ooh, how did that happen? Maybe that was it. But that feeling of connection... I could be a stranger in, for example, when we went to, when I would travel, when I would go someplace, plop down in the middle of a city that was not my home, Chicago, New York, L.A., San Francisco, Houston, didn't make any difference. I felt like I was still connected. I didn't live there. Just visiting, passing through, whatever. But connected. Hey, hey, Americans. Hey. Oh, I know what that is. That's a skyscraper. I know what that is. That's a park in the middle of downtown. I know what that is. That's a bus. I know what that is. That's a subway. Eh. You know, everything was just so familiar and so open to my connecting, plugging in, you know, like a robot. Connecting. I'll be a son of a bitch. I don't feel that anymore. I really don't. I don't feel it anymore. And I keep looking for it. Do you? I mean, I'm looking for that feeling of connection, of, hey, you know, I really belong here. This is really me and mine. And hi, everybody. Hey, yeah. Hello. No, I don't know who you are, but you're on a bus. We got buses back home. Hey, hi. Hello. What the hell happened?
Better stand back. Here come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Gordon Beznoska. Thanks, Gordon. Email here from Joe in Temecula, California writes, hello, Mike. Until Karl Rove, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld are in jail, I really don't want to talk about whether or not Julian Assange has broken any laws. A lot of these right-wingers swear breathlessly in a panic over WikiLeaks while calling for the assassination of Assange are the same right-wingers who yawned when Karl Rove outed a CIA agent. They called Valerie Plame a desk jockey and said she wasn't really working on anything related to national security. Karl Rove and Dick Cheney committed treason by outing Valerie Plame, and we will never know how many people died as a result. Valerie Plame was working on the tracking and sale of nuclear material in the Middle East, and these right-wingers said that wasn't a matter of national security. Now, if these right-wingers call for the immediate arrest of Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, George W. Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld for a whole host of charges related to treason, torture, and jeopardizing our national security, then perhaps I will entertain a conversation about what laws Julian Assange may have broken. If these right-wingers throw Karl Rove et al. In jail without bond while indictments are prepared by the Department of Justice, at that point, I'll be willing to listen to their arguments about how Julian Assange is somehow a threat to national security. Until then, all these teabagger right-wingers need to sit down and STFU. Joe in Temecula, California. Yeah, it's amazing let me retract. It's not amazing. It is expected and still somewhat shocking to know that people on a television network, the Rupert Murdoch Anti-American Terrorist Network, funded in part by the same people, the same Saudi royal family that funds the madrasas, that produce terrorists, so-called, who want to kill Americans. Rupert Murdoch and his associations, from Glenn Beck to the Saudi prince, are interested in one thing, dead Americans, as many as possible and as quickly as possible. But to know that this strange cadre of half-wits who work for the Murdoch terrorist organization in the guise of newsreaders or news reporters are calling for the assassination of an Australian citizen who did nothing more or less, guilty, not guilty, how do those terms apply anymore? He did nothing more or less than the same thing a newspaper editor does who is handed copy. I've written for enough publications to know that when you turn in something, you may write it on spec, which means, well, the editor said, well, that might be a good story, or the assignment editor, that might be a good story. Go ahead and write it for me. We'll see. I used to hate that. And the other thing is when you're given an assigned story and you go write it, you turn in the copy, and whether or not it's going to be published, it, again, is unknown to you until the managing editor calls and says, your check is in the mail, we accepted the piece. Julian Assange was an editor. He didn't bust into the State Department and take these cables. He didn't bust into the Defense Department and take the cables regarding Afghanistan and Iraq. He didn't do that. He's an editor. He is, in fact, a journalist. And this is why the terrorists who work on television in the guise of reporters or newsreaders or journalists, God forbid, are so freaked out because they're looking dead on into journalism. And it scares the Christ out of them. These swine who work at the Rupert Murdoch Broadcast Terrorism Network, Anti-American Broadcast Terrorism Network, do you think those swine have any idea of how to conduct themselves as journalists? Of course not. So when all of a sudden a journalist dumps out there for everyone to see the pettiness, the lies, the characterizations, the duplicity, this is top secret stuff, this garbage that's out there in WikiLeaks? How so? What national secrets are being revealed? Except the secret that we all keep in this country, that we live in what Greg Palast called it, an armed madhouse. An armed madhouse. Wasn't that originally that was Vonnegut's term? So, you know, here we are, and there is one person on earth, apparently, who has the ability to have these articles on spec turned into him. He's a managing editor, or he's an editor in chief. And then he goes to journalists that have outlets to publish this stuff. Le Monde, Der Spiegel, El País, The Guardian. And he says, here are the stories. Now let's sit down and figure out what part of this has to be kept away from the public so that it's not to jeopardize. And the swine who work for the Rupert Murdoch Anti-American Terrorist Broadcast Organization have the audacity to say he should be assassinated. Stick around. The third hour is a real barn burner. It's coming up. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. Before I get back to some more WikiLeaks stuff, which is fascinating to me. You know, maybe you don't care to take a look at the stuff that Julian Assange has died to release. No, he's not dead yet. He just soon will be. Well, don't you think? Especially what the document dump has revealed about Russia. Oh, my God, a mafia state. Well, there's a surprise. We are not far behind that. But before I get back to that, Mefloquine. I think I'm pronouncing it right. Mefloquine. It's a drug. It received FDA approval in 1989. The brand name is Larium, L-A-R-I-A-M. It is a anti-malarial drug, ostensibly. That's what the manufacturer says was the reason for its creation. However, there's a huge body of evidence out there now regarding the neurotoxicity of this drug. And its propensity to cause very serious neuropsychiatric side effects. Now, adverse events, as they're called, associated with mefloquine include depression, suicidal thoughts and behaviors, intense rage, paranoia, hallucinations, and anxiety. An Army public health physician told us that use of the drug was akin to pharmacologic waterboarding. Why would an Army public health physician be commenting on this? Well, because there is an investigative piece conducted by Jeff Kay of Fire Dog Lake blog and Jason Leopold of is he at Truth Out or Common Dreams? Truth Out, I think. This drug was forcibly administered to all detainees at Guantanamo. In our torture facility in Guantanamo through 2005. From the time the torture facility was set up by the Bush crime family until 2005, which is roughly, 4 years? This is like the MK Ultra experiments that we all are familiar with, or you should be familiar with. It's also like the experiments as laid out in the, remember the film Jacob's Ladder? I've recommended this movie several times. If you haven't seen Jacob's Ladder, it's one of the scariest movies I think Hollywood ever produced. So now it turns out that this drug, mefloquine, was forcibly administered to every single detainee, whether that detainee had malaria or had been exposed to malaria or not, in an Army physician says the use of the drug was akin to pharmacologic waterboarding. The article that contained that statement by the Army has been removed from government servers. It was on armedservices.house.gov website. And as Jeff Kay from Fire Dog Lake writes, the article has evidently struck a nerve with Department of Defense and our members of Congress, as one of the key documents in our story, the research that he and Jason Leopold have done, a September 2002 letter from Deputy Secretary of Defense William Winkenwerder to the Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee was scrubbed from government servers. The document itself is still available through Google Docs cache and is also being posted at Truthout servers. Anyway, Winkenwerder's letter notes that, quote, malaria is not a problem at Guantanamo. And it makes other statements that undermine the Department of Defense's insistence that treating hundreds of detainees presumptively with a treatment dose of mefloquine was a mere public health measure. What does mefloquine do to people? Beep, 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 Boop, boop. Here's some testimony gathered by the website Larium. That's the trade name, lariuminfo.org. You can go there. Lariam. That's the brand name of the drug. Lariuminfo.org. Here's one. After taking Larium, I developed rapid heartbeat, paranoia, and panic. I have since had episodes of severe panic, depression, sleep disturbances, shaking, flushing, feeling of foreboding. This is by far the worst thing that has ever happened to me. The psychotic episodes are nearly unbearable. Here's another one. I was not warned of the dangerous side effects, ended up in a mental hospital by the end of the trip because no one could explain my manic behavior. My brother flew down from the States to get me because I called home several times stating that my boyfriend was trying to drug and kill me. Here's another one. I served in Somalia in 1993 for 5 months. I took Larium once a week for the entire tour. That was 8 years ago. I have been diagnosed with PTSD by the VA, received 100% disability. I have attempted suicide 10 times, have shot myself. I suffer from severe depression. I learned about Larium on the Internet about 3 years ago, but was too depressed to do anything about it. And this is what they were giving, or what we, not they, we, the United States, by God, America, this is what we were feeding to the detainees. As Jeff Kay from Fire Dog Lake writes, the primary story is out for all to read, and it is my hope that this will help lift the lid of secrecy that still permeates U.S. government torture against the detainees. A Seton Hall report, drug abuse, an exploration of the government's use of mefloquine at Guantanamo, will be released in the next day or two and will expand the legal repercussions of using this dangerous drug on detainees. You can go to truthout.org and find this about the government's use of this drug on detainees. It's astonishing. Is there nothing remaining that the United States will not do that government policy for explicitly forbids? Is there anything, any area, whether it is torture, MK Ultra-like experiments on detainees, assistance from the psychiatric community in the United States in measuring how much torture and pain can be administered before the torture and pain has to be stopped to give the body a chance to recover before beginning the torture again. Is there anything left? Execution of American citizens, summary execution, if they're suspected of any type of activity that might or might not be involved in terrorism, is now permissible thanks to a directive signed by Obama. Such a directive was out there under the Bush crime family. But remember, Obama was the savior. Obama was the one who was coming to save us all from the perdition we were being cast into by the Bush crime family. And apparently that's not going to happen. And of course, these dumbass, filthy Republicans squat like toads underneath some dank, wet pile of leaves, insist that Obama's a socialist. No, he is exactly the same, you morons, as your patrons. But your patrons, the capitalists in this country, want to get rid of him and replace him with somebody from their echelon, not from community service. You know what I mean? We'll be right back.
border to border and coast to coast, The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
21 past the hour. The article is up at truthout.org, written by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay. You might want to check it out. In the article, it mentions that mefloquine, also known by its brand name Larium, L-A-R-I-M, it was researched by the U.S. Army. There's your first clue, in the 1970s, and licensed by the FDA in 1989. Since its introduction, it has been directly linked to serious adverse effects, including depression, anxiety, panic attacks, confusion, hallucinations, bizarre dreams, nausea, vomiting, sores, homicidal, suicidal thoughts. It belongs to a class of drugs known as quinolines or quinolines, which were part of the 1956 human experiment study to investigate toxic cerebral states as part of the CIA's MK Ultra mind control program. So go to truthout.org and read this. Seriously. You know, here we go again. And when you read this by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, when you read this, check out what you're thinking about as you read it. You know, seriously, like, this was done with the explicit, not permission, but on direct orders from the executive branch of the U.S. government under the Bush-Cheney terror organization. And regardless of Barack Obama's promises when he was a candidate, that operation continues. Now, of course, we don't torture anymore. But you know, when I read this, I just thought to myself, is there anything left that will not be done in the name of the American people? I think about that a lot. When empire starts to die, as this one has been doing now for a little over a decade, when it starts to die, that's when it is its most dangerous, any empire, because it realizes it is dying and starts to lash out in insane manner, in an insane manner. And it becomes evil. Its activities become purely evil. What would you call the indiscriminate slaughter of people in the Middle East, our indiscriminate slaughter, our support of other countries, political support, financial support, who also engage in their own indiscriminate slaughter for their own ends? What do you call that? Do you call that politics as usual? Do you call it the American way? Do you call it insanity? Or do you call it evil? I don't believe in intrinsic evil. Intrinsic. That's what the religionists talk about, you know, good and evil, this constant struggle in the universe between matter and antimatter, I guess that would be the physical way of looking at it. I guess what I believe in is derangement and non-derangement. But what do you call this if not evil? What the United States, what we support, used to be we supported it with our tax money. Now we support it by going in debt. The Chinese or whoever is buying our bonds and our bad paper, they're more than happy to finance our own destruction. I mean, this is madness. Who doesn't understand this, what is happening in this country? Who doesn't get it? Well, apparently about 80% of the population doesn't get it. But what do you call it? When a country does what we have done in the Middle East, we had no problem referring to people outside this country as evil. You know, the usual historical gang. You know who I'm referring to. All these people have decided it's time to murder as many innocent human beings as they possibly could. Whether it was Adolf Hitler or the Catholic Church or Pol Pot or some bastard dictator that we funded and supported in Central or South America, we don't have any problem labeling those people as evil. Why is it so difficult to label the leaders of our own country, their actions anyway, as being evil? I have an idea about that. And I want to share it with you when we come back. It's something that Bob Alexander sent me a couple days ago, literally a couple days ago. It's about ponerology, the study of evil. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
The fact is there's these people that they said they had to bomb, when in fact it was just a wedding. The fact is there's these prisoners buried in the sand, mass murdered in containers. The fact is, in Afghanistan, more died than in New York, and most of them civilians. Hail Caesar! This is what you're fighting for. The king of death row, Texas, elected by his brother-in-law. Hail!
Can you hear that? Don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Before I get this thing with Bob Alexander, just remember here, and I think this might be getting lost, if media were doing their jobs, WikiLeaks would be unnecessarily redundant. And also keep in mind that what is being revealed are cables written by the U.S. diplomatic establishment. That's all. I mean, this is not stuff that is some secret formula that Julian Assange has figured out and is presenting revealed truth. All Assange has done is released cables written by members of the United States Diplomatic Corps. Ooh, they're supposed to be secret. It's insane. And for the third time now, this is the third release, it shows the pimps and whores that make up, no offense to sex, well, I don't like pimps, the pimps and whores that make up what is supposed to be our precious First Amendment protected national press. It shows what thugs they really are. On MSNBC, the criticism of Julian Assange has been just over the top. And on Fox News, no less, they're calling for his execution. You know, a terrorist organization run by Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch. And funded in part by the Saudi royal family that also funds madrasas that turns out people who want to murder us. And you don't think Rupert Murdoch is a threat to this country? Oh, my God, are you stupid? But Fox calling for his execution. What did he do? He did something that would not be necessary if media were doing their jobs, right? Hey, Mike. Now that the big bird has been carved and turkey sandwiches, casserole soups, and lesser forms of foul leftovers will dominate our lives until Christmas, the spirits from last Halloween have not yet returned quietly to their graves. In the dead of night, they beckon to us with their filthy hands to follow them into the Shadowland. There in the murky, eternal twilight, the ghastly, ghostly procession leads to the blasted heath where the shades of the past give way to the dominion of the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Here there is always time for one more ghost story. There exists a a darkness within all of us. We have all thought, said, or done things in our lives we're not proud of. In times of extreme emotion, we've had thoughts we wouldn't want anyone else to know about. We have a shadow side, a reservoir for our darkness. From those waters, we draw shame, sorrow, and regret. Knowing of our own darkness, we can see how each of us, under the right circumstances, is capable of terrible things. We have seen in the human continuum saints and monsters. We believe we are all capable to some degree of being like one or the other. Henry C. S.E.E. has co-edited the book Political Punerology, A Science on the Nature of Evil Adjusted for Political Purposes by Andrei Lobachevsky. The book is about the origin and true nature of evil and shows how it has spread throughout society. The term punerology is a theological term meaning the study of evil. We feel a sense of shame and remorse about the dark side of ourselves. We project onto others that they have the same capacity for these emotions. We are convinced of this. We believe this, and we are wrong. In an interview about the book, Henry C. corrects our mischaracterization. He says, quote, "This projection is where we make the fatal mistake. It is this idea that we are all somehow perverse or pathological in some ways that serves as a major prop to the pathocratic system and makes it possible for psychopaths to hide in the general population. There are two issues this raises. First, Mr. C. goes on, there's a world of difference between someone who, in the heat of an argument with a significant other, loses control and physically or psychologically abuses that person, and someone who coldly, with calculation and forethought, carries out the same thing. The acts are wrong in both cases, but that same person who loses control momentarily would be unable to think through and coldly plan out the same act. Something inside of him or her would recoil. In the psychopath, that voice of conscience does not exist. Psychopaths are capable of plotting out the genocide of a people such as the Palestinians, people of conscience or not. One person may be killed in a heated argument. Many thousands can die from cold calculation. End quote, Henry C. Bob goes on. We recognize that psychopaths live in the world, but we are unaware that they are the creators of the world. As Clinton Callahan wrote in his article, Beware the Psychopaths, My Son, quote, I make the effort to share this information because it gives me at last a plausible answer to a long unanswered question. Why, no matter how much intelligent goodwill exists in the world, why is there so much war, suffering, and injustice? The answer is that civilization as we know it is largely the creation of psychopaths. All civilizations, our own included, have been built on slavery and mass murder. Psychopaths have played a disproportionate role in the development of civilization because they are hardwired to lie, kill, cheat, steal, torture, manipulate, and generally inflict great suffering on other humans without feeling any remorse in order to establish their own sense of security through domination. The inventor of civilization, the first tribal chieftain who successfully brainwashed an army of controlled mass murderers, was almost certainly a genetic psychopath. Since that momentous discovery, psychopaths have enjoyed a significant advantage over non-psychopaths in the struggle for power in civilizational hierarchies, especially military hierarchies. Behind the apparent insanity of contemporary history is the actual insanity of psychopaths fighting to preserve their disproportionate power. And as their power grows ever more threatened, the psychopaths grow ever more desperate. We are witnessing the apotheosis of the other world, the overlapping criminal syndicates that lurk above ordinary society and law, just as the underworld lurks below it. During the past 50 years, psychopaths have gained almost absolute control of all the branches of government. You can notice this if you observe carefully that no matter what illegal thing a modern politician does, no one will really take him to task. All of the so-called scandals that have come up, any one of which would have taken down an authentic administration, are just farces played out for the public to distract them, to make them think that the democracy is still working. All hierarchies inevitably become top-heavy with psychopaths. Since psychopaths have no limitations on what they can or will do to get to the top, the ones in charge are generally pathological. It is not power that corrupts. It is that corrupt individuals seek power. One of the main factors to consider in terms of how society can be taken over by a group of pathological deviants is that the psychopath's only limitation is the participation of susceptible individuals within that given society. Lobachevsky gives an average figure for the most active deviants of approximately 6% of a given population. The next tier of such a system is composed of individuals who were born normal, but are either already warped by long-term exposure to psychopath material via family or social influence, or who, through psychic weakness, have chosen to meet the demands of psychopathy for their own selfish ends. Numerically, according to Lobachevsky, this group is about 12% of a given population under normal conditions. So, add the two numbers. Approximately 18% of any given population is active in the creation and imposition of a pathocracy. The 6% group constitutes the pathocratic nobility, and the 12% group forms the new bourgeoisie, whose economic situation is the most advantageous. The real problem is that the knowledge of psychopathy and how psychopaths rule the world has been effectively hidden. If there is any work that is deserving of full-time efforts and devotion for the sake of helping humanity in the present dark time, it is the study of psychopathy. And the propagation of this information as far and wide and fast as possible. There are only two things that can bring a psychopath under submission. One, a bigger psychopath. Two, the nonviolent, absolute refusal to submit to psychopathic controls, no matter the consequences. If individuals simply sat down and refused to lift a hand to further one single aim of a psychopathic agenda, if people refused to pay taxes, if soldiers refused to fight, if government workers and corporate drones and prison guards refused to go to work, if doctors refused to treat psychopathic elites and their families, the whole system would grind to a screeching halt. So now we know how to overthrow the insane people in charge of our country, Bob writes. And unless Americans figure out how to turn French in a hurry, we all know why it will never happen. To completely understand our dilemma, I suggest everybody get a copy of Political Puneralogy by Andrei Lobachevsky. Think of it as a much-needed lump of coal in your Christmas stocking. Regards, Bob. Before the hour, you know, that makes perfect sense what Bob sent in here, his own personal comments, interspersed with editing and reviewing of this book about puneralogy, the study of evil. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. I hope it's not puneralogy. Puneralogy. And how psychopaths dominate all of the processes that constitute what we get involved in this society. And if you look around the globe, most societies, I mean, you don't have to look far. Most of us are totally blinded, or at least myopic, where it concerns our own structures. We can look. As a matter of fact, we're trained. We're taught to look at the evil, for example, in Zimbabwe. The president of Zimbabwe, Mugabe. We're trained to see the evil in Pol Pot, in Mao, in Hitler, in Stalin. But why are we not trained to see the evil in in our leadership? I mean, what did we do to indigenous people here is one of the things I'm getting to. Was it any different? What did we do to Africans? Was it any different, truly, now, seriously, in terms of the total number of dead and tortured than what Hitler did to the Jews and to other people as well? Well, what's the difference? Is it a quantitative difference or a qualitative difference or is it a political difference? What difference is it? Psychopaths have the ability to organize things, right? So according to this theory, it doesn't take many, maybe 18% of the population. The other 82% is deaf, dumb, and blind and not paying attention even in the most egregious circumstances. We have become a torture nation. And we justify it. We accept the evil of torture by simply saying, well, you know, those people would have come here and killed us just like they did on Line 11. When the fact remains that missing a system of justice, nobody can make that kind of a statement. There's the trials that were held were supposed to be held where the best elements of the law would be applied to find guilt or innocence. None of that is done. We just label them as evil. What did Dick Cheney say? The worst of the worst reside at Guantanamo, and they must be destroyed. Kill them! And now here we have the case of Julian Assange, who releases documents provided to him. He didn't break into the State Department and get this stuff. He releases it. And the filth over at Rupert Murdoch's terror organization is calling for his execution. And the morons at CNN and MSNBC are painting Julian Assange as some kind of an evil son of a bitch, when in fact all he did was reveal the evilness that we perpetrate against the rest of the world. Of course, the rest of the world perpetrates it against us, too, when they have a chance. Do you think Netanyahu is not evil? Do you not a psychopath? Do you think Ahmadinejad is not a psychopath? Do you think Vladimir Putin is not a psychopath? Please. Thank heavens, literally, that radio astronomers are finding the universe may be triple its previously thought size in terms of available places where there might be life. I wonder if it is as effed up there as it is here. I really do wonder that. I wonder. But this whole subject of ponerology is just fascinating, isn't it? That the organizing principle of the power structure is psychopathology. unless someone says, hey, have you studied this? Do you know anything about ponerology? Who would have thunk that the organizing principle is or could be, at least these people make a strong argument for it, psychopaths. The actions of psychopaths. Every empire has been built on genocide and slavery. Are those the actions of a psychopath or a collection of psychopaths? I would think so. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? What else would you call it? If not psychopathology, what would you call it? It's a scary subject. It really is. It's just spooky. It is so spooky that the organizing principle of society is madness, a madness of a sort that is amoral, able to commit mass murder, able to commit torture, genocide, massive destruction, up to and including now the destruction of the planet. I mean, when you stop and think about that, it's like, oh my God, that can't be, can it? But somebody labels this and identifies it and said, okay, here, study this. Take a look at this. And refute it if you will. Argue with it if you choose. But present a coherent argument against the idea that psychopaths have organized civilization or empires. Argue against it. Make a case. And then before you do that, though, look at the world. Find a spot where there is a paradise. And what is paradise? It would be, wouldn't it be simply the lack of psychopathology? Wouldn't that be paradise? The absence of madness? Okay, it's pretty late, but I think I better go have a drink. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.